Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Natalie Fixmer-Arise. I'm an associate professor at the University of Iowa.
Prof. Natalie, thank you so much for being here. And I know because you're my eyes on the ground today that it's raining in Iowa City.
It's very rainy and cold and dreary, and so I'm wearing all of my warm things.
But isn't that, we were just sort of gossiping about this a moment ago. There's a sort of pleasure in having the right clothing on. The worst thing is when you've made
So
a
true.
huge mistake in the clothing,
Correct.
right? Just totally
Yes.
wrong.
Yeah. I did not make that mistake today.
Right. The weather forecast was slightly off, or you didn't look at it, or you didn't look out the window before you left home, you know, those sorts of things. But everything's set, you're fine. Prof, my first question is to ask what's currently preoccupying, interesting, retarding, dynamizing you? What's happening right now?
Well, I love this question. It's so big. And, you know, my first response is that I am a little under the weather. I think I've caught my eldest cold, but I'm trying to, you know, hold it off a little bit. So the weather kind of feels appropriate to me, and it's an invitation to get warm and cozy. And the thing that's really, you know, I work in reproductive politics, and there's a lot going on in that world right now. And the thing that really buoys me is a strong sense of community and being kind of in community with people who are doing related kinds of work for reproductive justice. And just last week, we hosted a couple of scholars on the University of Iowa's campus. We hosted Natalie Lira, who's faculty at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana. And she's written this beautiful book called Laboratory of Deficiency. It's an early history of eugenic sterilization and confinement of Mexican origin women in the United States, in California, at a place called the Pacific Colony in the early 20th century. So she wrote this beautiful book, which is about all of those things. It's about gender, race, class, and disability, and confinement and sterilization. And it's also about how these young women in these conditions, you know, cared for one another and enacted resistance in ways that they could. And she's dealing with a pretty intense archive. So I really appreciated her attention to the myriad dimensions of that archive that she could draw out. So we hosted Natalie, and we hosted at the same time Angela Hume, who is faculty at Cal Berkeley. And Angela's work is about, she just wrote this beautiful book called Deep Care. And Deep Care is about DIY self-managed abortion and the like radical feminist health clinics in on the West Coast in the Bay Area in the 60s, 70s, 80s, up until the 2010s. And so both of these books together, we did a big event together and talked about these books, put them in conversation with one another in a public setting and a venue. And it was just a delightful opportunity to think about usable histories and the kinds of lessons from our history that can inform the way that we move through a difficult moment in the present.
And can I ask you about that with reference to Iowa? What's the climate
Yeah.
in terms of reproductive justice in your state?
It is precarious, right? Iowa has the recent history of abortion politics in Iowa is that at the state level, the state constitution has been interpreted in such a way that the standard of for any kind of restrictions on abortion was strict scrutiny. So it was the highest kind of constitutional standard that disallowed most restrictions on abortion, right? It basically recognized abortion as a state constitutional right as well as something that's recognized by the federal government. In 2 weeks before the Dobbs decision in early June of 2022, the Iowa State Supreme Court issued a ruling that demoted the standard of scrutiny and said that, you know, I forget the exact legal language, but essentially allowed a waiting period to go into effect in the state of Iowa, which wouldn't be something that would be allowed if strict scrutiny were remained the standard. So they, right before Dobbs fell, the state lowered its commitment to protection for abortion care. And immediately following the Dobbs decision, which of course allowed states across the country to criminalize abortion care, and that's what we've seen in lots of states in the US right now. Our governor, who is a very, very right-wing Republican, much in the kind of same vein as DeSantis, Florida's been referred to as the or I'm sorry, Iowa's been referred to as the Florida of the North or the Midwest. Lots of similar forms of legislation. So our governor immediately attempted to resuscitate a 6-week ban that she had passed and that was ruled unconstitutional by the state Supreme Court in 2018. She tried to resuscitate that ban immediately following Dobbs. That didn't fly. The state Supreme Court turned that down. And so last summer, the state legislature held a special session to enact another 6-week ban. That ban is being heard before the state Supreme Court in 2 weeks, and we expect a decision in the months following that. I'm kind of in the weeds of policy right now, but I guess what I'll say is that Iowans, by and large, really support abortion rights. And so these policies are very out of step with what polling shows, which is that like 60% of Iowans support safe and legal abortion, and 70% of Iowa women support safe and legal abortion regardless of their political affiliation. So these policies are unpopular, and they are lockstep in line with the GOP nationwide. And so what I'm seeing in Iowa is just a real attempt to not only shortchange the capacity to access abortion care, but we're seeing a lot of attacks on trans people, the LGBT community. That's my community. It's a distressing moment and place to be in.
And just for the majority of listeners are outside the US, though the plurality is within, putting this in the, I was going to say wider political context, but what's wider than reproductive issues? But you know what I mean. Let's say the general party political context, which you've already raised. Iowa is extremely important in national elections. It can be a really important state, not only in terms of if in the past, early votes to see who would get the nomination of parties, not so much now, but in the general election itself, in terms of which way it goes. How are you seeing things at the moment? It's clear there are some slightly less insane elements of the Republican Party that realize they've got to be softly, softly on abortion.
I can't hear you.
Oh, can you hear me now? Sorry for the delay, folks. We had a technological problem. I was just asking the prof if she might explain to us a little bit about the national political context and its relationship to Iowa, because it seems as though some of the less crazy bits of the Republican Party are realizing that abortion could be a real vote winner for the Democrats. Reproductive justice could send a lot of Republican women away from the ballot box or towards Biden. And it also seems as though the Democrats are just a little bit unclear about how to play this. So, at that level of national party political issues, where do you see this happening and what do you think it might mean in Iowa?
I think what I can say with certainty is that every time we have tested abortion at the ballot box with voters directly across the political spectrum, whether you think of a state as a red state or a blue state, and those determining that's a vexed kind of metric because, of course, there's a lot of diversity within American states, and so. In any case, from Kansas and Montana to Ohio, Voters have really rejected restrictions on abortion rights. And I think, what's interesting is that in Iowa, they had the Republicans were advancing legislation that would have put something on the ballot to ban abortion in the state constitution, and they quit advancing it. So we're not going to see abortion on the ballot on the, as a voter referendum in November. And that's because the Republicans decided against, and I can't comment on their logic, but what I can point to is that the national context suggests that that's not a winning issue for them. And I think that Democrats would do well to seize on this issue even more than they already have.
And you mentioned trans questions. This is one of these issues, a bit like critical race theory, where it seems as though Republican devotees think it matters a lot, but the vast majority of Americans actually really couldn't give a toss. I mean, it just doesn't matter to them. It's not that they think this is appalling or this is good or it's mildly bad. It just doesn't register as mattering, right? And so I wonder whether the Republicans will charge in on the, the lot with the logic that on cultural issues we can win.
I think, as a member of the LGBTQ community, like I've been, and I've, and as a kind of queer elder, because I'm in my 40s now, in my early adulthood, we saw a lot of like bans sweeping the states across the country that would ban gay marriage. And, we saw Prop 8, and we've seen our community under attack before. This is kind of the latest iteration of the culture wars. And I think it's the this tiny segment of the population that identifies as like genderqueer, trans, non-binary, gender expansive, that the Republicans think they can just target and make a wedge issue out of. And I think, I've been so inspired by our trans youth who are like leading, they're revolutionaries, right? They're leading this revolution. They're bringing people to the table who've never been part of like queer liberation. So, for example, like my partner, who is non-binary elected official, has been, working with these trans kids in Iowa, talking to them, especially with the attacks on gender affirming care for trans youth, which happened in Iowa last legislative session in 2023. They enacted a ban on minors' access to care. And, some of the folks that started showing up to these meetings were pretty surprising people in the sense that they'd never been a part of this conversation. And they'd say things like, well, I've never been active on these issues, but, I've got a trans grandkid, or I've got my daughter's trans. And I don't really understand, like, why the governor cares which bathroom my kid uses, right? And so all of a sudden it's, welcome to the revolution, my partner likes to say. And I think, I do think that I think that more and more people are caring. I think more and more people care that they see this as an attack on people's humanity, on their dignity, on their human rights. And I think it's a backlash because we've had so much kind of queer and trans visibility, and visibility is a double-edged sword. And so, and if I'm to, if I, you know, I study the history of reproductive politics in the United States, and I think, and how it's those histories are entangled in right-wing movements, authoritarian regimes, and like white supremacy. And so if you think about, my first book was really about the surveillance and control of pregnancy, and the kind of articulation of white motherhood as this vehicle for the nation. And if you think about it in those contexts, the queer and trans folks are a direct challenge to the gender binary that is the cornerstone of white supremacist nation building. And so to me, like, it's reproductive politics are at the center of a lot of these struggles in ways that are more and less recognized, I guess. But
And
it's not coincidental that you're seeing the rise of right-wing authoritarianism alongside attacks on abortion care, alongside attacks on trans non-binary folks. Those are very linked to me.
the book you're excuse me, sorry, Prof. referring to is Homeland Maternity, which comes out when Roe v. Wade is still the law, but makes points, as you say, about the relationship of maternity, particularly white maternity, to the US nation, and also to the intensified forms of surveillance as part of US nationalism that occur in the 21st century. I'm sorry. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. I'm sure you're sick of Adam rating your book, but if you could just tell us a little bit about the idea of maternity and nation, but also maternity and surveillance, homeland security, the entire spying and policing apparatus of the feds.
Thanks for that question. I'm actually Maybe I should get sick of, at some point I'll get sick of talking about these issues, but they do occupy a lot of my brain space. So, the articulation between white motherhood and nation is a very old one. So, I kind of my book is about a recent iteration of these politics, and you can go back to the very kind of founding of the US Republic. Linda Kerber is a historian who wrote about Republican motherhood. And she wrote about how, at the founding of the US Republic, wealthy white women were tasked not with citizenship and enfranchisement, right? But at their contribution to the nation was literally about birthing the white sons that would inherit this nation. And, the work of reproductive justice scholars like Dorothy Roberts and Ricky Solinger have looked at like the, from slavery, where we were defining bondage as contingent not on the status of the mother, right? We were, and what that did was it enabled white men's rape of black enslaved women to perpetuate white supremacy, right? Like that, your status as a child when you were born was either free or enslaved based on the status of your mother. And that was a change in law because, historically, lineage has been patriarchal, recognizing a paternal lineage, not a maternal one. So, looking at some of the histories of reproductive politics and how motherhood has been, shored up and supported or not supported. We don't have any social safety nets here in the United States, but certainly kind of, promoted for white women, and the motherhood of women of color, indigenous women, black women, has been pathologized in the United States. And so there are lots of reproductive justice scholars who talk about this in the United States over time. In my book, I look at how the logic of the security state in the early 21st century kind of reanimates white motherhood as a vehicle for the nation, and how the app how it uses all of those governing tools like surveillance, like one of the things that I've been trying to talk with, I've talked with some local elected officials about, has been the rise in crisis pregnancy centers in the United States. Are you familiar with crisis pregnancy centers?
I must admit I'm not.
I don't know. It's I think it's a very US, I know it's a very US phenomenon. They're fake health clinics. They are run by the religious right. I know you've been in the US a lot and lived here and worked here, and you've probably seen their billboards, right? They put out billboards that say pregnant, scared, come to us, free pregnancy test. And they're run by the religious right. They're staffed by church volunteers, and there are no medical personnel, working in these facilities. They offer over-the-counter pregnancy tests free to people who walk in the door. They outnumber real reproductive healthcare clinics in the US on average 7 to 1. But in many states, it's much, much more than that. Here in Iowa City, I know we have at least two. in Iowa City. And the dangerous thing, and the reason that I bring up crisis pregnancy centers in the context of surveillance, is that they have to date dodged legislative attempts to curtail what they do. Because what they do is they bring people in, they give them pregnancy tests, they say, you're pregnant, and then they provide a lot of anti-abortion counseling. They use scare tactics, they don't give people real information, they'll lie to folks, tell them they're further along than they are to try and prevent them from seeking abortion care. There have been lots of really good studies that look at exactly what crisis pregnancy centers do and how they use disinformation to persuade, to dissuade patients or people seeking abortion care from receiving that care. And the way that they've dodged any kind of attempts to legislate what they do is that they have dodged medical privacy laws. They've dodged consumer protection laws because they don't sell anything, right? They're giving everything away for free. The dangerous thing is that they're also not bound by medical privacy laws in the United States because they're not medical providers, right? They just pretend to be. And so because they're not bound by medical privacy laws, if you turn over your information to a crisis pregnancy center, right? And then you walk away from the clinic and you say, well, I'm going to think about my options. Legally speaking, there's nothing that bars those center staff from turning around and giving your personal information to law enforcement or anybody else in your life, right? A parent, a lover. And so, what we have is an incredibly dangerous, in the context of criminalized abortion care, a really dangerous surveillance apparatus set up and networked across the United States. And that to me is one of the most frightening kind of post-Dobbs realities.
Oh, excuse me again, sorry, Prof. One of the things you do in the book is not only look at attempts to force people in a way to become mothers, but you also look at when it's the wrong kind of mother or the wrong number of children. You know, all these things, scare quotes or bastard quotes, as they're sometimes called. And I'm thinking here in particular of your bravura chapter on Nadia Suleiman, so-called Octomom, whom people outside the US may not necessarily know about, or people may have almost forgotten. But it was a front page story at the time. And I wondered if you could talk a bit, not if you wish to, about that chapter, but in general about the idea of, the wrong kind of mother or the wrong number of children. Again, these terms wrong are not used innocently, they're used connotatively, critically in the case. Yeah.
One of the interesting things, I mean, gosh, Nadia Suleiman has been in papers again in the last couple of years because, and in a way where journalists have issued a kind of apologia for the way that she was targeted by media as, this like irresponsible, kind of the trope of the welfare queen, that controlling image, which is about policing poor women's motherhood, women of color's motherhood, and at the same time, what struck me as so bizarre about that particular case was that this was a moment when mothers having tons of children was kind of having a heyday in the United States. And what I mean by that is simply that, there was John and Kate plus eight, and there were all of these reality programs. I always mess up their last name, the Duggars, the Duggars, Michelle and her 19 and counting. She'd been named like Arkansas Mother of the Year, a couple years prior to Nadia Suleiman having eight children. She was the media dubbed her the quote unquote Octomom. But her case really catalyzed or reinvigorated a long-standing dominant cultural narrative around motherhood, which is that essentially motherhood is thought of as like a privilege, not as a right. I think that's the most direct way to say it. It's something that for for those communities for who have had to fight for rights, existence, access to resources, motherhood has been a site of radical claiming, like a radical right to live, right? And to create family. That's a radical act, right? When you're from a community that has been historically deprived of that right. And we see really overt, we've seen very overt attempts to control who gets to be a mother and who gets to be a parent in recent years. When you look at like the forced separation of families at the US-Mexico border, or you look at sterilization, forced sterilization happening in ICE detention in the United States, immigration detention in the United States, or prisons in the United States. State attempts to control who does and does not reproduce, right?
Absolutely. And I remember when I lived in the US as a child, but when I went back as an adult, it was the heyday of the attack on the so-called welfare queen. This was, apart from being clearly racist and anti-proletarian and sexist, also part of a wider campaign to destroy the pitiful amount of welfare that is available in the United States or was available. And this was bipartisan. And it's one of the appalling Clintonian legacies that we live with still. And so much of it articulated around women's bodies. So much of it.
Welfare was very popular in the United States in the early 20th century when it was for white widows. It was seen as, a really good use of state funds to make sure that we support white children and white mothers. And the stereotype, the welfare queen, became this object of intense scrutiny and disdain and this kind of controlling image. Patricia Hill Collins talks about controlling images, right? And in the 70s, 80s, and leading up to the destruction of the welfare system as we knew it in the 90s under the Clinton administration. And that was absolutely about a very robust kind of feminist welfare rights led by Black women, women of color in the United States to gain access to benefits that had historically been allotted for white women, right? And so this is absolutely about, white supremacy, anti-Black racism, and the kind of perpetual stereotype that circulates in dominant US culture that Black mothers in particular are not worthy of support.
Right. Returning to one other theme, if I could, in your really pathbreaking book, I wondered if you could talk to us in general terms, perhaps theoretical terms, but also US historical ones, about this image of woman and nation, this image that is in so much art as well as mythology of men fighting other men in the name of the semi-naked female figure who is the nation. Even as during these wars, they're raping women.
The first thing that popped into my mind was for the very famous piece of art that was the kind of Manifest Destiny. Do you know which one I'm talking about with like I'm forgetting the name of the piece, but she's holding, I believe she's holding a torch. She's this white woman dressed in white, and she's the figure of kind of the westward expansion and white settler colonialism and the justification for that. And so there are lots of another example is in the post-World War II period. The glorification of the white middle class nuclear suburban family and the really kind of pronatalist patriotic campaign to get women, white middle class women out of the workforce, right? Because women who had not worked historically in the United States went into the workforce to support the war effort, right? And so there was a very concerted campaign to get them out of there when men returned at the end of World War II, and to kind of glorify child rearing and homemaking as this kind of site of patriotic duty for white women. I don't know if that answers your question, but
No, that's very
those are the things
helpful.
that
And
came
I
to mind.
think I'm thinking maybe, is it the John Gast picture where there's a white woman who's sort of flying over the earth in a semi-upright position, making her way westwards, the manifest?
Yeah.
I don't think she's got the torch. I think she's, I'm not sure. But anyway, I think
I, yeah.
that's one of them. And you get them all over the world. On Sunday, I was at the Prado Museum here in Madrid, and it's full of topless women, very white, with all the light in the painting focusing on them in the way you get in classical Hollywood cinema. And everybody else is sort of a spectator looking at this person who is almost a deity. Someone to be struggled for, someone to be attained. But of course, with all the other connotations that we're discussing. And it is, I think, quite remarkable in that on the one hand, it excludes women from the struggle for nationhood and victory, but also makes them the prize. And
Yeah, I
the
mean,
booby prize they get, as you say, is that Rosie the Riveter goes home and makes babies.
right. I mean, I think there it's you know it's there's a very in some ways it's unsurprising, right? That this and this isn't, as you say, it's not specific to the US. There's this great project. So the University of Cambridge, I'm affiliated with their reproductive research network group that's there. And there are scholars from all over the world studying different facets of reproduction, reproductive politics. And a small group of these scholars are looking at what they're calling reproductive righteousness, the Reproductive Righteousness Project, which is about, alignments between anti-abortion politics, anti-birth control projects, and the rise of the kind of the authoritarianism. And it's absolutely about controlling this kind of vigilant control over the future of the nation, what is envisioned as the future of the nation. And in moments of, upheaval, demographic shifts, there tends to be, historically, we've seen like an uptick in the kind of cultural anxieties around who, which people, which communities are reproducing themselves, and how that impacts the future of the nation, right? There are similar debates. They're all kind of infused with, like, there's racism and xenophobia in like the anchor baby, quote unquote, that those kind of controversies that, a couple decades ago were animating US politics around, women coming, immigrant women, undocumented, coming to the United States to have babies and to be allowed to have access to a legal claim to citizenship or route to citizenship or residency. So yeah, they get animated in lots of different ways. And this isn't just in the US, but in places across the world.
And relatedly, but slightly differently in terms of both the genre of writing and also the topics, my edition, the latest edition at any rate that I have of Gendered Lives is the 12th.
Oh, yeah.
And you're the co-author. I wondered if you could tell us a bit about that and the difference between what is sometimes thought of as a research work and a textbook. Now, of course, these things can and often do cross over, but excuse me, pardon me, Prof. What was it like doing the textbook? And of course, it's also a directly collaborative venture. It's a co-authored work and it's a renowned, object, as it were.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. It's really an honor to get to work on Gendered Lives. Julia Wood is a beloved mentor of mine, and I was introduced to the study of gender my first semester of my master's program by being assigned to TA for Julia to be her, teaching assistant for the class that used gendered lives. And so prior to that, I hadn't had a lot of exposure to gender studies, feminist studies. And so I learned a lot alongside my undergraduates that semester. And it really, for me, catalyzed a new trajectory for me of possibility in the world of research and academia. And so to kind of come full circle years later and have Julia ask, would you be willing to co-author this book with me was really an honor. We are currently at work on a new edition, and the world of gender changes so quickly. The 12th edition was revised in the summer of 2016, and numerous things have changed since then. We have new vocabularies, new conversations, new policies, all impacting gender. And so it's, I'm actually in the process of revising the textbook right now. And Julia is retired. She stepped back from the project, but I draw on her expertise regularly, and am working also with like a former student of mine on some of the content. But in terms of it's delightful to have an opportunity to be in conversation with younger, not younger, but like college age students, and in an introductory format, right? I know you've written for these audiences as well, but to think about how do we translate research and scholarship in ways that really directly speaks to students who have very little exposure to gender, and that tries to engage them where they're at. And so using, trying to, pull from popular culture and, have conversations with my own students, because I'm teaching that textbook this semester in my gender comm class. And I'm always asking them, so like, tell me, what are the music videos that are popping up in your mind as you're thinking about this material? And like, what kinds of conversations are you having with your friends? And so it's a delightful mode of engagement, really. And it is a nice, it's nice to have an opportunity to shift gears a little bit and
Yes.
talk differently with folks.
I wondered if I could ask you about that teaching issue, because particularly for young women, during your time at Iowa, these questions have become, if anything, more pressing than ever before. And I know I had a brief opportunity to be a visiting professor in New Orleans when the Supremes took their fateful decision. And, young women standing in front of or behind me in the line to buy a milkshake or whatever were all talking about it and about how they would, where they would go for termination services or advice or whatever, which state they would go to, how long it would take to get there. I mean, really, it was suddenly a thing, understand, because they'd grown up probably, I mean, these were liberal, basically liberal cohort. They'd grown up with their mothers probably saying, I hope this never happens to you against your wishes, but if it does and you don't want to go to term, you'll always have a way. You know what I mean? They'd grown up in that world, which was suddenly shattered. So I'm interested in whether or not you've seen a change in the undergraduate student population's discussion of these topics in the last, say, 5 years, and obviously the last 2 years in particular.
Absolutely. And I'm seeing it across the board. What I mean by that is in my classroom, Iowa students I've been here for almost 12 years now. And when I first joined the faculty, I've been working on these issues, reproductive justice issues, my entire adult life. And there wasn't really an appetite. People were reticent in the classroom to discuss birth control, abortion. I think in part because they saw it as a lightning rod issue, but they also saw these issues as like settled domain. They didn't have to worry about struggling with access. And I think that that's changed, and they are voicing increasingly vocal about their concerns, and they're feeling the effects of this generationally. This is happening alongside concerns over climate catastrophe, and it's happening alongside their increasing sense of lack of safety around gun violence in the United States. So young people in my experience in the years that I've been here have become increasingly more vocal, more organized, more political. Part of that could be the kinds of students that come to my classes, because I'm teaching classes about gender, and now I'm offering, and it's filling to capacity every single time. I'm teaching a class about the politics of reproduction, which I would not have taught, 12 years ago, and expected to have it full, right, in the same way. And so there's that piece of it where I'm seeing students increasingly engaged. And then there's the other piece of it, which is that, before I went back for my PhD, I did community organizing for Planned Parenthood, and I worked in the politics of these issues from a different angle, advocacy, public policy end. And one of the things, and then, during my PhD, and I've just been involved in these activist circles and enclaves for a long time. And what I've seen is that over time, and partly this is me like going from being in my early 20s to in my early 40s, but part of it too is just a shift, right? Where a lot of the organizing work, it was hard to get younger people involved, like people of my generation really involved in reproductive health and politics. And at least I felt like we were the smaller community in the room. And now that's really shifted. And I'm seeing that these circles, these activist enclaves, are full of young people committed to doing this work. And I feel like that is a sea change. And that hasn't been just the last couple years. It's been growing for some time, but it truly is like this beautiful multi-generational struggle at this point, reproductive justice, and a lot of it is, numerous kinds of inspiring coalitions that is, beyond generation.
Prof, I've got a couple more questions for you, if I may, and then I'd like to ask you to add anything to what we've said. Might be touching on a topic we've already mentioned or something entirely new. As part of your ongoing participation in joint projects, you published fairly recently an article about the idea of the green wave being a source of inspiration and guidance. Could you tell us a wee bit about that?
So that essay, that collaboration comes out of my work here with my colleague Lena Murillo in history and gender, women's, and sexuality studies. And she is brilliant. We do a ton of work together. She's just a luminous human being and just a brilliant public intellectual. And her book is going to be coming out probably in the fall, and it's called Fighting for Control. And it's about the history, early 20th century history of struggle for abortion rights led by Mexican origin women on the US-Mexico border. So I highly recommend checking out Lena's work. She and I have done a ton of work together at the University of Iowa's campus on reproductive justice. And one of the things that we wrote was about the calls from these activists in Latin America for the US, like this invitation for the US in the wakes of the Dobbs decision to join the Green Wave, because in, Latin America, kind of drawing on the struggles around the mothers of disappeared children and the struggle against really right-wing violent right-wing regimes and political oppression and violence and murder and disappearance, the women who were organizing there were, th that that legacy of movement organizing is what the Green Wave activists were picking up on and wearing green bandanas. And one of the most inspirational things that these feminists were talking about, and it began in Argentina, they were talking about how green is the color of life, and that color, that life should return to us, right? That reproductive, the deprivation of abortion care, the lack of access to abortion care is violence. And the reframing of reproductive violence as gendered violence, as political violence, has really catalyzed this sea change. We've seen really rapid change in laws in various Latin American countries, including, in 2021, when the state of Texas criminalized abortion care and allowed people to, encouraged peer surveillance by placing, by offering money to people who turned in anyone violating this law. In the same month, the Mexican Supreme Court decided to decriminalize abortion. And so we're seeing this kind of this shift. And we wanted to write an essay that not only built on these calls for US activists to join a more global hemispheric movement for reproductive justice, but that underscored that, in the United States, there's a lot of US exceptionalism, right? This idea on the right, on the left, that the United States is this like beacon of human rights and social justice. And that fallacy has been rendered so clearly untrue in the wake of Dobbs. It's a moment, right, where US activists can be a little bit more humble and realize how much we have to learn from folks who have been organizing about against really brutal regimes who have used reproductive violence as one facet of its violence, right?
Thanks for explaining it. That's wonderful. And my last question before throwing to you, Prof. N, is to ask you a boring question, but it's the question that the University of Iowa biochemist, agronomist, dean of X might ask when you're going up for promotion to full professor, which is, how do you know these things? You know that question, that slightly hostile, how does she know all this stuff anyway? How do you know? In other words, what I'm really asking is, how do you choose your topics and how do you do your research?
My brief answer is that I read a lot.
You'd be surprised how many people give that answer. And then they elaborate a bit, but basically they're saying, I read a lot. And I'm thinking, that's a pretty good damn answer if you ask me.
Isn't that the point of research? I got into this so that I could always be learning, right? I mean, I read a lot, and I'm trained in cultural studies, communication studies, and I'm deeply attentive to, how communication shapes our understanding of the world. And so those are the that kind of question about how do we create narratives and meaning around some of these issues? How does that shape the world that we live in? How does that shape the worlds that are possible? How do activist enclaves use communication and storytelling to identify moments of solidarity? And how do they use those that same storytelling to create other worlds of possibility? Those are the things that really animate my thinking. Yeah, I don't know if that's an answer, but I
No, that's
do
very
read a
good.
lot.
Congratulations. You have been promoted. You
Thank
don't need to worry
you. Thank
about.
you for flagging that question for me. I hadn't anticipated it.
Oh, it's one of the things that really good tenure and full promotion letter writers for cultural studies people in the US know, that the good old boys and some of the good old girls have hanging in their minds.
Yeah.
So, anyway, enough of that. Prof, to conclude, I'm wondering if there are things that you'd like to draw our attention to that we haven't discussed, something you've got on the burner, something you've
Yeah.
else you're interested in, or something you want to add to what we've already mentioned.
Well, my second book is going into production right now, and it's another
Whoa.
collaboration, yeah, with a dear friend of mine at the University of Kentucky, Sharon Yam. And we have written this book about, after writing a book about the intense surveillance and policing of pregnancy and motherhood in the United States, I wanted to write about sites of resistance to that. And I wanted to write about queer family formation, queer world making as sites of resistance for that. And one facet of that is this book that will be coming out soon. It's called Doing Gender Justice, Queering Reproduction, Kin, and Care. And in that book, we are looking at we're looking at trans and non-binary birth, and we're looking at how queer activists, queer parents, self-identified radical doulas providing care in birth settings, as well as reproductive justice advocates and public intellectuals, are trying to use storytelling and use various kind of modes of communication at their disposal to, again, create safe, affirming spaces for queer and trans birth and to expand our repertoire for kin and family. So I'm excited about that.
Fantastic. And when will that be out?
You know how these things are. It just went into production. I imagine we're about a year out, maybe a little longer, but it just depends. Copy edits soon and then
That's
so on and
exciting.
so
And I
forth.
think I may have
Yeah.
spoken over you when you said the title.
Doing Gender Justice, Queering Reproduction, Kin, and Care.
Oh, wonderful. So thank you so much, Prof. Natalie. It was really wonderful to speak to you, to learn so much from you. And I really hope listeners go and read some of your work because it's fantastic. It's been great
Thank
chatting.
you. It really is such an honor to be on your podcast. I've really enjoyed listening to it. I really appreciate your work, and thank you for inviting me.